Welcome to Phenomenal Woman. I'm your host, Janice Sutherland. Join me as we share the success strategies of phenomenal women achieving extraordinary success around the globe. From the good, the bad, the ugly, and everything in between, this is Real Talk by Real Women. We share with you the highs and lows of their journey and give you honest insight on how you can navigate same with confidence, integrity, and gain a little inspiration. As a leadership strategist, executive coach, and business consultant, I have the pleasure of working with organizations and individuals, helping them to turn their goals into success. So hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Phenomenal Woman. This week, I'm in conversation with Brenda Lee Brown. Now, Brenda Lee was born in London to Antiguan parents. She studied journalism and started her career in the black media before moving to Antigua in the mid-1980s, where she began writing and publishing short stories and poetry. In the mid-1990s, she returned to the UK and gained an MA in writing from Sheffield Hallam University. She returned to Antigua in 2003 and established Just Write Creative Writing Workshops and has worked with government agencies, adults and inmates at Her Majesty's Prison in Antigua. Her work has appeared in a number of anthologies in the USA, UK and Canada, as well as online. Brenda is the mother of one and a lover of cricket, chocolate and handbags. And I'm also delighted to say she has just been in the process of launching her new novel, London Rocks, which I have read and we'll talk about it. I'll talk to Brenda about it during the interview. So Brenda Lee, thank you and welcome to this week's Phenomenal Woman. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you, Janice, for the invitation.
You're welcome. Now, that was a very, very short introduction. And I know there's so much more to know about you. So tell us a little bit more about yourself and where you come from.
Okay. I was born in London, born and raised in London of Antiguan parents. Grew up working class background. Dad worked in the factory. Mum was a seamstress. But they had middle-class aspirations like most West Indians, immigrants at that time. And they wanted us to be a teacher or work in a bank or work for BT or have an established career. But I always wanted to write. I didn't really know about being a writer. I knew I wanted to write words. So my first passion was magazines and books. So I used to buy, remember Jackie?
Oh my gosh, the Jackie magazine.
A girl's comic magazine. The first one you buy as a preteen. And I was fascinated by that world. And I was like writing little bits and pieces, but I never really thought about being a writer. I thought I wanted to be a journalist. Okay. And that was what I thought I wanted to do. And was discouraged because at that time, Britain wasn't used to the idea of young black youths with ambition.
Right, yes.
You came over with parents who the majority were working class, so we were supposed to be working class.
Yeah.
And I remember my careers teacher telling my parent, my mother, that I couldn't be a journalist.
Right.
And that you don't realize how much that impacts on you until you're much, much older. And I've probably spent a good 5 years drifting.
Right, right.
Trying to be not what they wanted me to be.
Yes, fighting it.
Before I finally took the leap to become a journalist.
Right. So what was the main motivator for you taking that leap?
My grandmother, my father's mother's death, sudden death.
Oh, okay.
I'd come to Antigua to see her in the summer of 82. Had no clue what this place looked like, had no idea what I'd find.
Yeah.
Heard all the old talk about walking for water and goats and what have you. Came here and cried for 2 days because I didn't want to stay. And by the end of 9 weeks, I was in love with Antigua. And 3 months later, my grandmother passed away suddenly. And I just thought, you know what? She died without me doing what I really wanted to do.
Right.
So I'm going to become a journalist. So I went to, I knew the editor of and publisher of West Indian World, which was in Tottenham, a gentleman by the name of Corley George, who was also Antiguan.
Right.
And went and said, I want to be a journalist. And he took me on. I wrote this most amazing essay, stroke report.
Right.
For a women's basketball match. and Rodney Hines, who's now at The Voice.
Okay.
300 Wins, and I started there.
Right.
And then a year later, there was a course advertised at the then Polytechnic of Central London for black journalists to get a diploma.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe work in the mainstream media. I got onto that course. It was like 12 for print, 12 for radio, and I got on that course.
Right, right. And as, and the rest of this, say, is history.
Yeah, it was a struggle history, because I was doing something that I liked. I didn't like writing news. I found that incredibly boring. Right. I liked feature writing. I liked to work on the story behind the headlines. And I still didn't realize that was because I wanted to write stories.
Right, right, right,
so
right.
It kind of took a while. It took coming to Antigua for that side of me to fully reappear.
Okay, okay. And what do you think was the apart from your grandmother's death, what do you think was the driver? What was it about Antigua that made you want to write or do the features? What was it?
You know, I think it's, I was away from the UK, where you're expected to be a certain way and a certain, have a certain career and a way of life.
Right.
B, I had time.
Yeah.
It was a slower place.
Yes, yes.
And I met people who write.
Okay.
And one of them was the late Leonard Tim Hector, who introduced me to Dr. Althea Prince, who's based in Canada. And I started seeing other writers who looked like me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, yeah. And there's a history.
Right.
And Makeda McKell gave me a copy of Why Sargasso Sea by Gene Rice.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We do write.
Yeah.
Even though I'd seen African-American writers.
Yeah.
And loved them.
Yeah.
You know, Alice Walker, Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, many others.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was the first time seeing our story in print and meeting people here that were writing that really made me say, you know what, I can do this too.
Right.
And also, yeah, realizing that your voice mattered. Because I wasn't Samuel Sevelon. I wasn't writing The Lonely Londoner. I was the Londoner.
Yeah, yes, yes.
You know, so
and that's
my generation. It took coming here to see that my voice was a voice that needed to be heard.
Yeah. And there's two things I'm getting from you from there. The one is about, I suppose, for want of a better word, conformity. Because, as you said, we're expected to follow a certain path. We're expected to do certain things because of our parents. And then secondly is coming to somewhere that you gain a sense of belonging. Yeah? So from the conformity piece, what was it like to break away from that?
It's been a very long journey to actually accept the fact that I broke away from that.
Okay.
When I came here, I didn't come here to stay as such.
Yeah.
I came on that 6 week, 6 month stay and ended up being 10 years the first time.
Wow.
And I struggled with the fact that I wanted to be here, but I was British.
Right.
And so here they called me English.
Yes.
In England, they called me a West Indian.
Yes.
Or African Caribbean or whatever the new label is at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I struggled with trying to own myself.
Right.
So I was forever fighting, you know, because I belong here. And it took a long time for me to say, actually, I am of here.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And that's great. But I'm also of Britain.
Yes.
And that's good too.
Yes. And it's a dichotomy that what I call British Antiguan. British Antiguans have, because like you, I have an affinity for both because I grew up in one, but I feel so at home in Antigua. And my mother always says, I can't believe you're such an island girl. You know, and I turn around to me and say, you know, you can't choose where you're born, but you can choose where you live.
You know, so
yeah, I belong to that generation of parents that planned to retire home.
Yes, yes, and never got there. Well, mine certainly didn't. But I know a lot. I know a lot of people.
I belong to that generation where parents retired. Antigua was a place, the Caribbean was a place where you retired to.
Yes.
It wasn't a place you went to live.
Yes.
When I came out, my mother thought it was crazy.
And even
my dad was like, oh, okay. But my mother was like, what are you doing?
And even when you get here, people think you're crazy.
Things I've experienced here, things I've done here.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So, Brenda Lee, what has been the most satisfying challenge you've overcome throughout your journey?
Wow, that's a question. The most satisfying, I think, still being here, being comfortable now in myself.
Yeah.
The work is the work, and I'm really proud of the projects I've been involved in, the work I've done as a writer, as an event manager. You know, I've worked with some amazing people in amazing places, but I think staying close to myself.
Right.
No, I haven't lost myself.
Okay.
All that I've done, I've stayed. I've accepted my craziness. I've accepted my Englishness. I've accepted my Antiguan-ness. I've accepted me.
Okay.
Well, it's still a work in progress, but I'm a lot closer now. So that's what I'm really, I think, staying true.
Okay. You say you're a lot closer, you're not there yet. What would push it over the edge?
When I stop looking backwards and going, maybe I should have, coulda, woulda.
Yeah.
I'm still, you know, there are moments when I'm just like, you know, I've got friends who have amazing jobs in the UK, earning 99 times my money. And I'm just like, what are you doing? And then I get an offer, a contract. You know, I've worked in India for the last eight years on a cricket series.
Right.
And that, I think, was really where I went, yes.
Right.
I love the country. I love the people. And it made me more aware of my creativity. So I started taking pictures.
Yeah.
I started writing other stuff. And I realized that I respond to my surroundings creative-wise.
Right, right.
So when I'm in England, I take pictures of the things that I like.
Right.
But I don't really write that much.
Okay.
India and Antigua, I write a lot more.
Right.
And still take pictures of what I like.
Right.
But I think in England, you're so busy being.
Okay.
You're visiting.
Yes.
You've got to see people.
Yeah.
You've got to go shopping. We've got to go shopping. Let's not pretend. You know, important things. But you've got to see people, family. So your time is always taken up with.
Yes.
So I find that I'll write less.
Okay.
When I get back, I'll process it and probably write more. But everything I'm doing, everything I've done has influenced and impacts on what I write, how I write, even with the pictures that I take.
Right.
That have been informed by this journey.
Okay. So you talked about looking back. You talked about looking back and maybe seeing some of your friends and where they are. I was going to come on and say that, you know, that I think it's all relative because they probably look on you and say, wow, you know, she's living this life. She's living her life. I wish I could do that. I wish I could step off the rat race or whatever, you know. So I think it's all relative. But if you could go back and change one thing, what would it be and why?
The thing I would have changed, I would have stayed in 1982. And not gone back to Britain when I did.
Right.
Because I knew this was home.
Right.
And I listened to my family. What are you staying here for? Go back to Britain.
Yeah.
And I listened to that. I would listen to me more.
Right.
And not get so caught up in what family expect.
Yeah.
And I would have trusted my writing more instead of waiting for the right time to be a writer.
Yes, yes.
Because I've encouraged so many people to just write, and I love working with young people and other writers, and I spend a lot of energy pushing others.
Yeah.
And realize that if I put a little bit of that energy in myself, you know, everything's at the time supposed to be. So this is what the journey had to be.
Yeah.
For me to do what I'm doing now. So.
And I really resonate with the thing you said about everything being just right, not just in the work, but just right. Because, you know, who's to say what defines a writer, your piece, you know, because I've started writing. And I'm like, who's going to read this? But then I put it out in the blog post and I get the response I get back is like, oh, it really resonated. I can see this. I'm like, wow. You know, so you don't really know who you're going to touch. You know, you can't touch. You don't need to touch millions. You just need to touch one with your writing, and that leads me quite nicely on to your book, London Rocks. Yeah. So tell the listeners a little bit about London Rocks and the inspiration behind it.
London Rocks, my first novella, published novella, full piece. It's about a young man called Dante Brooks coming of age in the late 70s, early 80s in London when sound system was king. You know, being black youth at that time, your world evolved around sound systems, raving, the party, the blues, the nightclubs, you know. So I've written about a time when our identity was wrapped up in music.
Yes.
It informed the way we spoke, it informed the way we dressed, it informed what we did on the weekends or during the week. You know, so I wanted to write a story, especially from the young people in my world, my son, my niece and nephews and their friends, to say that the struggles that they're going through, we know because we did it,
yeah,
you know, back then. And back then we didn't even know what we were doing, we were just doing.
Yes, yes.
But Dante, I wanted to first of all to write about a young girl at that time, and she wasn't happening.
Right, she wasn't really.
This young man in the story said, I have a story you need to hear.
Yeah.
So I let him tell his story. And his journey, although it's condensed, I wanted to show that young men need a release. They need someone they can trust to talk to, because we tell them to man up, don't talk, hold it in. And in the book, we see the consequences of when they hold it in.
Yeah.
And the consequences of when they find a safe space or person.
Yeah.
In Dante's world, it's the safe space is behind the microphone.
Right.
And eventually into books, where he starts to write down what he's feeling.
Yes.
And with a person that he meets.
Yes, yes, yes. And I'm glad you said it was condensed, because I found myself wanting to know a little bit more each time, going, what next? No, don't jump onto the next bit. You know, but I mean, having grown up in that same era, I felt myself transformed there. I could feel myself there in that time, in that place. It really resonated with me. And there's even things I forgot. I found myself going, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. So, you know, so it, like I said, and there was so much, I thought there's so much we could go into, you know, into Dante and what was happening and his relationships. And like, you don't realize when you're going through it or you're living through it, how much it impacts you, or what a release it is. So it was a fantastic, fantastic, fantastic read. What next for Dante?
Oh, thank you. Oh, it's Dante. As I told some people recently, I haven't seen Dante since I finished him about 7 years ago. And about 2 weeks ago, he said, hello, I'm back.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I found myself scribbling a couple of lines. But the beauty of writing is that you never know when the character will come back, or if they want to come back.
Right.
And the reason why the book was the way it was is because Dante was like, look, I'm not fully formed, but I want to give you a little slice of life.
Right.
So I'm going to let you see what I see and feel but I don't think I'm not fully ready to give you everything I have.
Right.
That's what that was so good about writing with Dante's voice, is because he was like, I'm young, I'm hustling, I'm moving, but I'm still growing, but I'm not quite grown. I didn't want to give him too many endings.
Right, okay.
Because he was still growing.
Yes.
And I thought, I've talked enough for now, so, and he was done.
Okay.
I'm not going to force anything else out of him.
So through that process, you really heard Dante's voice speaking to you, so to speak.
I did.
Yeah.
I think what happens a lot of people, I'm a firm believer that as a writer of fiction,
yeah,
if you're writing a piece of fiction based around the character of characters, you've got to let them breathe.
Right.
Because when the reader reads it, they're going to know if you forced it.
Yes.
Or if it happened to that character.
Yeah.
So it was important for me to let Dante do what he did, say what he said, without judging and putting my judgments on him.
Right.
And that's the trick that you take. It takes a long time for writers to be confident in their character.
Right. Right.
So I'm not the kind of writer, I don't plot. It works for some writers, doesn't really. I tend to do an outline.
Okay.
I have an idea, and I kind of write down a character drawing. So I will say the age, who I think they like, but I'm still feeling them.
Okay.
And when I start writing, and I just write. I just start to write.
Okay.
And then I leave it, go back, and chop and change. And then luckily for me, I had Joanne Hillhouse is one of our best young writers around in Antigua and the Caribbean right now. And she was one of the first persons I showed the manuscript to.
Okay.
She was a Dante fan from day one. She did the first full edit. Yeah. And that was the important part, because when Joanne read it outside of my head,
yes,
she showed me the flaws, she showed me, she asked me questions. She didn't change my style or direction. She just said, you know, is that necessary? Right. And that's the question you have to ask yourself with anything you do.
Yes.
Is that necessary?
Yes. You
know, and that response. And so that was when I realized that, oh, maybe Dante. And Joanne grew up in Antigua, so she has no reference point.
Yeah, yeah.
What I shared.
Yeah.
But she could see the story, and that's all I wanted.
Excellent.
Whether they lived in Antigua or America or Britain or Africa, I want them to be able to see the story and understand Dante. My son is 26.
Yeah.
He's a little bit older than Dante is at the end of the book. But I understand, you know, young men now are still going through that thing that Dante was, that search for my voice, my space, my safe place. And it's even more relevant now in the UK because of all that's happening
amongst
the British youth. You know, the black-on-black crime. They're still being profiled.
Yeah.
They still feel that they don't have anywhere to go. That to prove themselves is to be hard on the streets. We had that conversation 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's true.
So even though the book is set 40 years ago, it is incredibly relevant to today.
Yeah. Okay. So listeners, go out and get a copy of London Rocks. You won't regret it.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
I did. So Brenda Lee, share with us a success quote or mantra that you use and why it's meaningful to us.
Whoa. Wow, that's a good question. I actually don't have one mantra. I think the thing I look at. Yes, I actually don't have a specific mantra, but there's three cards I keep on my writing desk, and they have the simple phrases: thank you, be patient, and live beautifully, dream passionately, love completely.
Okay.
And I have those because I have to learn that this journey needs patience.
Right.
And everything that happens, say thank you, and try to live live up.
Right.
You know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
But every day I breathe, I'm surrounded by some amazing people. So I've got to always remember to say thank you for every opportunity, big or small.
Yeah.
Whether it involves writing, whether it involves traveling, whether it involves teaching or just being alive.
Yeah.
You know, thank you.
Yeah. Excellent. Lovely. Now, you're a writer. And you also threw out some books, Samuel Selvin, Lonely Londoners, and Why the Sargasso Sea. But has there been a book that's influenced you throughout your career journey? And what would that be, and why? What's been your learning?
This is gonna surprise you. The book that really resonated. Well, there's three books that really resonated with me. Oliver Twist, Charles Dickens.
Okay.
Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte.
Okay.
And The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck.
Steinbeck, yes.
Because those three books, I go back to every year. The depth of the visual story. Yeah. These people write incredibly visually, and I'm a visual writer. So I see their worlds in 3D. I'm a person, I like to, when I read something, I will say I see it.
Yeah.
I need so. But Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, Grapes of Wrath and Wuthering Heights, I saw those worlds. I felt, you know, Wuthering Heights with Heathcliff and Catherine and the Moors and the wildness of their love and the wildness of their behavior and how she matched that up. And to think that she lived in a house on the moors and had very few friends, but yet could create this world and passion.
Yes.
You know, Dickens was a socialist who tried to change the world through his stories, saying, you know, poverty is bad, people. There's nothing glamorous and glorious about being poor, you know, and Wuthering Heights and Grapes of Wrath. I see, I had no clue about the Great Depression in America.
Yes.
And to read about people dying for just because of want of food in a country that has abundance.
Yeah.
And they were white.
Yeah.
Blew my mind.
Yeah.
But again, the detail and the vastness of the landscape as he described them driving in this Model T Ford, trying to get to the glory land of California.
Yeah.
Where there's already, you know, you just think that's the journey that we Caribbeans took to the motherland to get the gold, But the vastness of, you know, I'm trying to think of my parents on a ship at sea, leaving Antigua, and it's just seeing blue sea for weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
No clue of where they're landing.
Yeah.
Arriving somewhere where nobody wants you.
Yes, yes.
You know, and then carving a life and creating a safe space within your home for your children, because, you know, we grew up as West Indians in the house.
Right, yes, yes, yes.
English in school.
That's right, very much, very much.
But it's creating that space.
Yeah.
They weren't always right, because, you know, they took with them what they knew.
Yeah.
And tried to mold us and craft us with what they knew. And yeah, some of it was good, some of it was a little shaky. But, you know, they did what they did, what they thought was best.
Yeah.
And coming a mother, I realized that that's the same thing I try to do with my son.
Right, right.
Right. But with regards to writing, I mean, yes, I did read. The book that really got me writing in my own voice, though, was Disappearing Acts by Terry McMillan.
Okay.
Love story between a black male and female.
Yeah.
Which was ordinary. She met him, he met her, they had their baggage.
Yes.
They fell in love, they fell out of love, they got back together, they broke up, they had a child. And I thought, this is so much like my life.
Yeah.
Because I know. And I thought, yes, I can write like this.
Yeah.
So Terry McMillan's book.
Yeah.
It was the one that really tipped me over and made me want to write in my own voice.
Right, right.
And I actually had the pleasure of doing a masterclass with her in America.
Okay.
And her first words on the board was, if you're writing to get rich, don't stay in this class. And he was like, ooh! And she's like, no, you got to write to tell your story.
Yeah.
You've got to learn the craft. And she gave us a most amazing reference folder full of information of stuff we need to do as a writer. And I still have the folder up to now.
Wow.
You know, and that was in 2002. Yeah,
right.
2002.
Right. And so lovely. And, you know, we have very similar, in fact, incredibly similar reading histories, because I knew, and when you were talking about the different, the visual, I am very visual. And I could visualize it as you were saying it. It popped into my head. You know, I could see the dusty road, the Model T Ford, you know, I could see the Victorian London. You know, so yes, I totally, and yes, Terry McMillan, everything, you know, yeah, though I have to admit first, the book that really got for me was Colour Purple. Somebody bought me a copy of my 21st birthday, and it must have not long come out. It must have just come out, and I still have it. And that has always been a book that's touched me. So we have very similar reading histories. So Brenda Lee, looking back, what advice would you give to your teenage self?
Oh, don't wait.
Yeah.
Live. Jump off the cliff. You may almost drown, but you'll survive.
Excellent.
And it's your life.
Yeah.
When all said and done, if you can look in the mirror and like this person, you're okay. You're okay.
Excellent. And if you could choose your own mentor, I know you've mentioned quite a few, you know, great people so far, but if you could choose your own mentor, who would it be and why?
That's a good, who would I choose as my mentor now? Ooh, I think I would love to, Marlon James.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, Marlon James, because not just because he won the Booker Prize.
Yeah.
But I follow him on Facebook, and he's got the most amazing sense of humor.
Right.
He's also an incredible writer.
Yeah.
And yet he's not lost his Jamaicanness.
Yes.
He's teaching in America.
Yes.
He's a big 6-foot-plus black man who's gay, you know, and he's not and lives his life.
Yeah.
But he's still a Jamaican. He's still, and he loves music. He doesn't seem to take himself so seriously,
right,
but takes craft serious.
Right.
So I would love to be able to work with him.
Okay. Well, speaking out there, manifest itself. Who knows? We'll hear this. Who knows? Who knows? But I'm there with you.
Yeah, yeah. When I was younger, you know, it was Oprah, and it was the late Dr. Maya Angelou, and I was like, yeah, but actually, no. If I'm honest now, Marlon James.
Yeah. So, what are the three things you've learned about yourself then during your career?
That I can work incredibly. I can work incredibly hard.
Yeah.
I can be incredibly anal focused.
Right.
And I give 150 to the project that I'm contracted to work on.
Excellent.
I give 150.
Excellent. And what would you say your imperfections and how do you embrace them?
My anal focus. My impatience, my impatience with, because sometimes I see things as quite simple.
Yeah.
But others don't necessarily see it that simple. I'm always like, why you don't understand? It's just a cricket match. I'll say something like out loud and totally offend 1,000 people at the same time. Because I have to remind myself that it is what it is. I'm not curing cancer. What we do gives people joy. Let's not pretend, and it pays people. It creates livelihoods for people. But in the end, it's not the whole of life.
Yeah,
you know. I'm also I can be quite serious, So and it can be very off-putting. So it comes across as arrogant.
Yeah.
As arrogant. And it's taken me a while to, you know what? When I have on my work face, that's what I'm paid to work.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, so I have to learn to kind of sometimes step back. Yeah. And not be so in people's faces, like, we're doing what you're doing. Let's do it now.
Yeah.
Just step back slightly. So I learned in India. I've had to learn to step back slightly, but at the same time, own what I'm doing and make sure it's delivered.
Right. And so coming to the last couple of questions, we talked about the top where you said you'd look back and you'd saw how other people earning more money and your friends and had jobs. But now looking at that, what would you say is your definition of success?
I now know,
yeah,
I believe that it's being happy with the choice you've made.
Excellent.
And living it. You know, there are days when I realize I can actually sit at my desk in my pajamas and produce work.
Yeah.
Myself or someone else.
Yeah.
Go to a meeting, leave a meeting, and go somewhere else. You know, I'm not stuck in a tube train or on a bus or in a office from 8 to 4 with people I may or may not like so much. You know, I have choice. I can make choices now.
And
learning to work through those choices, because someday I have to make myself work.
Right.
I work from home most of the time, so that trap of I'll just put on the TV for 2 minutes to take a break. And 2 hours later, you're still taking a break. You know, and I try really hard not to do that midnight oil, all night, morning thing, unless it's the delivery of the project.
Okay.
I've learned to go to sleep.
Right.
There was a time when I first did events where you worked all night, every night, and I was like, well, actually, if you don't rest, you're of no use to yourself or anybody else.
Very much.
So, I have to work for 3 days nonstop. That's it. I'm not working 6 weeks nonstop.
Yeah.
I know when the event is on or the deadline is on, I'm going to meet the deadline.
Right.
But I'm not going to spend 6 weeks, 3 months, whatever, every No. Because when I drop down, I'm replaced.
They say thank you if they say that, and then there's a replacement as quick as you like.
And go home.
Yeah.
When I work with teams, with people, I tell them, we're all here to help each other. We're all here to be each other's back. And if you look good, the team looks good.
Yeah.
And we've got to own what we're working on.
Right.
Got to own it. You can't just turn up. And I've done that, you know, turned up, and I can always tell I don't engage in a project, and it shows in my work.
So I have to
own it. When I own it, I take it.
Excellent.
The 150 and go forward.
Excellent. And lastly, what does it mean to you to be your own hero?
Wow. No. I think, wow, to be your own hero, showing up.
Yeah.
Showing up and being there, not just for yourself, but for others in whatever way that is. Whether it's to the end of the line, listening to a conversation, making a call, standing next to somebody, talking, you know, just showing up.
Showing
up, being present.
Excellent. So that was my last question, Brenda Lee. It's been a delight in talking with you today. If people want to get hold of you or want to know more about Dante, how can they do that?
They can. I have a Facebook page, Just Right Brenda Lee Brown.
Okay.
And on there, there's lots of information about what I'm doing as a writer and Dante. They can purchase the book directly from the publishers, which is Hansi Publications at www.hansipublications.com, and they'll ship anywhere.
Yeah.
It's going to be on Amazon by the summer, so that'd be great. But you can check me on my Facebook, Just Write Brenda Lee Brown page, and we can have a conversation right there.
Excellent. And I'll leave the link in the show notes so everybody can get hold of you. So once again, thank you very much for your time, Brenda Lee. It was a sheer delight talking with you this morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Janice. And I'm looking forward to doing more work with you and your phenomenal program.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what a great interview with Brenda Lee Brown there. And it gave me some real food for thought. So as I said, there were some things about conformity, the things we do to make sure we, one, fit in, to make sure we do what we're told or what our parents are destined for us. And it takes some, I suppose, real strength and courage to go against the norm. As I say, only dead fish swim upstream. Only dead fish go with the flow. So it takes some real courage, to go against what society, what your parents, what people around you think you should be doing and what you should be following. So kudos to Brenda Lee for following her passions. And even when she did start following her passions, realizing that it wasn't that particular genre of journalism she wanted to follow, it was actually fiction writing. And she's done a fabulous job with writing London Rocks. So without further ado, that's the end of this week's Phenomenal Woman. I really do hope you've enjoyed the interviews. As ever, I'd ask you to show your support by commenting on iTunes, subscribing or sharing the show to other people you think would benefit from listening. And I do look forward to connecting with you next time.